Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgVenta Group. I'm Sarah Nolette. This episode is the start of a series that I'm really excited about, where we hear lessons from later stage AgTech startup founders. So these are companies with more than 50 employees, or in the case of our next guest, 300 employees. And we'll hear about their journey from founder to executive and what they've learned about business, the industry, and themselves along the way.
I always felt like I can't ask people to take risks and then slap their wrists when they fail. Like that is such a crazy environment to live in and to work in. And I think it's stressful and it doesn't work well. And so I have from the beginning said like, we're gonna make a ton of mistakes and that we will never fire anybody for a mistake, ever.
That's Michael Gilbert, the CEO and founder of Semios, a crop management platform initially focused on tree fruit, nuts, and vines, based in Canada. Semios uses the tagline Precision Agriculture as a Service to describe what they do. It's an example of taking a non-ag business or startup concept, like software as a service or SaaS, and applying it to ag. And in this series, we too will take some general startup concepts and see how well they apply in ag tech. So let's meet Michael, who has a PhD in chemistry and worked in pharmaceuticals before landing in the world of ag tech. Well, Michael, I'm so excited to chat. I have been following not only you on LinkedIn and the company's progress in the news, but just saw a few billboards of Semios in the Central Valley here in California. So you guys are literally everywhere, which is pretty exciting.
It is. Yeah. We've been, it's one of those, they call them overnight successes. You know, it's been 10 years in the making and it definitely has this arc of like slow, slow, slow. And then all of a sudden it picks up and then you're just kind of like holding on tight. And we're in that part of our growth right now. So obviously exciting.
Awesome. Well, I want to get into all of that, but let's start with your origin story, sort of personally. I think your parents were hobby farmers and you started your career in the pharma space, but tell me a little bit about your background and how you ended up in ag.
Well, I'm an army brat. So I moved every 3 years and the last posting my parents had, they bought a hobby farm just out of nowhere. And we went from living in apartment to hobby farm. And so we learned everything on our own. My parents had this ambition to have like essentially nothing bought. We bought sugar and salt and everything else we had to make from butter to cream to like everything. And we had like 60 different species of animals and it was just literally like a zoo. And what a blast for kids to be growing up in that environment. I mean, so much fun. And yeah, from then I went to school and became a natural product chemist and did a graduate school, PhD, postdoctoral fellowship, spent pretty much all my 20s learning about chemistry, did a stint in pharmaceutical product development, essentially taking naturally occurring chemicals and finding out how we can make them at scale for human use. And it's a very similar process in agricultural inputs. So for me, the switch from pharma to ag was not that much of a stretch for me.
Tell me more about this farm / zoo. What are some of your memories from that? Like, were you involved in some of the chores?
Oh, definitely. We had a very minimal budget. I mean, my dad still worked for the military. So, you know, calling the vet was a no-no. So we just figured everything out on our own. So I do remember a lot of the animal stories, like, you know, helping the pigs give birth, helping the goats give birth, like all these things that we just kind of, we had a book that was like our Bible, like look, page 43. Here's how you help a sow give birth to her piglets. It's like, all right. And then here we go. And it was like, it was drawings. It wasn't even pictures. And so you're just kind of like learning as we go. I do remember at one point we had 60 goats and we would milk them by hand. And we're living in east of Ottawa in Canada. So it's like minus 35 Celsius. And you're in there and the goat's like just the only heat in the whole barn. So you're just holding on tight, milking the goat. Next one, and then go to school. Yeah, you learn a lot about problem solving because you can't just call people to specialists and you just learn about work ethic. I mean, there's no days off. You can't just like, oh, I'm too tired. No, that's not going to cut it.
Oh my gosh. I ran a goat farm in Chile when I lived there. We had about 60 goats and same experience. It was freezing in the morning and sort of nice to be in the milking shed, smelly and, you know, all the different things, but like, they're not going to mess around. You're getting up and milking them. Yes or yes. There's no sleeping in. Did it make you want to work in agriculture?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely like, even my summer jobs, I work on farms. Like I grew up in that rural area. I'm definitely not a city person. So I definitely love the country. I love being outdoors. And so that was what appealed to me a lot. farming is just such a honest work and kind of keeps you honest and it's all real. I even found later on in my career doing things, even like chemistry, where you can work for a week and then not get anything really done. But on the farm, it never felt that way. You always had this feeling like you got stuff done. And at the end of the day, you could see your work. And that is such a rewarding feeling for anybody, is knowing that that day's work actually resulted in either a pile of hay or a whole bunch of carrots cleaned out of the garden or whatever it is. That sense of like accomplishing something is pretty exciting.
So how did you make the switch? Was there a moment when you're sitting there in the chemistry lab and said, no, I've got to go start an ag tech company? Like, how did that come about?
So I was part of a biotech company in Vancouver, and we were developing a heart medication. And I'd worked there for 3 years. We're about 100 employees. And we got our main product was sold. It was over $1 billion. It was the largest biotech deal in Canada at the time. And right after that, I was approached by a professor who had developed a pheromone that was going to be used for pistachios in Iran. So it was a very, very small, specific use case. And he asked if I want to help build a company around it. And so I was like, well, A, I knew nothing about the use of pheromones in agriculture. So looked into it, definitely my skill set in terms of scaling up manufacturing and all these things. But I hummed and hawed on whether or not I want to move to Iran or not. I was like, I had a young family. That was a big move. And in the time that I was like, you know, considering it, he sold that IP to the Iranian government. And so I was like, okay, well, so much for that. But it got me kind of like interested in this like space of like biologicals and pheromones and agriculture. And I started asking more questions about people like, why is this not being used at scale?
And it's that experience that spurred Michael on to venture into the world of entrepreneurship, starting out, like so many others, with just an idea.
As most entrepreneurs, I was on my own, you know, in my office trying to think things through. And coming from a science and biotech background, I had in my mind that I needed some real IP. I needed some chemical-based IP. And so my idea at the time was, these pheromones, active ingredients, are really expensive to produce. So one way we can make this better is find a way to make them like chop it up into a smaller piece and find the most effective part and then make it at scale, which is what we do in pharmaceutical products. We find whatever part of the chemical that's necessary, make it cheap, and then scale it. So I kind of noodle around on all kinds of patents, and it turns out that doesn't work. And so it was like totally a no-go. But in the process, I had been speaking to a bunch of federal agencies that fund research in clean tech and ag tech. And then it just started this little game of like, I'd get a grant for like $50,000, and then I could get some investment to match it, and just doing this little like side by side, which is what they want to see. Like the government takes a risk and then the investors take a risk. And that slowly started building up until we actually had enough funds to start hiring engineers, and kind of slowly went from there.
And did you have a kind of early vision for what this would look like? I mean, you started on the sort of product side, and okay, we need a physical product. Probably some of the tech money at the time wanted you to do something more digital. How are you thinking about sort of where this needed to go in the early days?
In the early days, it was definitely going to be around focused on pheromones and essentially bringing pheromone products to market. They're only used in like less than 1% of the market, and most of the market could use it. So I was like, well, why is that? And there's a whole bunch of technical challenges there. I thought, well, we can solve those problems. But it was mainly going to be, my initial vision was just delivering pheromones across the world. And it wasn't until, I think it was probably in our third or fourth year, that we had a bit of luck go our way. There's a technical challenge around these pheromone active ingredients, and we spray them out of like an aerosol, like almost like a bathroom aerosol sensor. And we spray them on demand, but sometimes if it's too cold, they crystallize at the exit place hole, and that blocks the exit. And so we put in some sensors just to kind of like short circuit that. So if it got too cold, it wouldn't spray. And so I'm collecting all this like temperature. And as it turns out, the sensor we were buying for temperature was almost the same price as the one that had humidity and barometric pressure. So I said, well, put them all in there, we'll see. And then all of a sudden we had like, on every acre, we had like the temperature, humidity, and barometric pressure every 10 minutes. And then our customers were saying, well, if you have that data, I need that for frost monitoring. And then I need that for disease monitoring. And then all these things that are coming from that single data set, which we hadn't installed for that reason. So it was a bit luck on our side that we put those in. It was like, I think it was the difference of a 7 cent versus an 8 cent piece. Like it was like a small difference, but made all the difference now.
What Michael just said is really key to building a company. Realizing your initial idea might not be the one with the most potential. To figure that out, Michael needed to get out and understand the pain points or challenges that his customers were facing. This meant finding those early adopters, which he admits was pretty daunting at the time.
I had in my mind that I had to go find the biggest and best customers to start. Like a lot of people were telling me, like, you know, go find a small farmer who's less risky. But then I thought, well, they won't know what my problem needs to be, how I need to solve the problem. So I went to the biggest ones. And I remember at least two trips where I would drive down with my entire team, which was like five people, in a car. We drove 6 hours to go meet a customer. And we got in and I was so nervous and didn't know how was I going to present this. I had my laptop. I'm going to show this to them. And we sat down and it was literally like not even 1 minute in. We haven't finished introductions yet. And he got a phone call and it was raining on his cherries. And he had to leave and go help with the helicopter to start deploying. And so I had spent 6 hours getting there and we got a minute in and he left. He said, sorry, guys, I know you came a long way, but I can't talk right now. So I just drove back, tail between my legs, just like, oh my goodness, what am I doing? And so those were really, really hard. I mean, I was just like devastated because I was just so pumped about even having a conversation. I didn't even get to have it. But we rescheduled, went back the next week, and he gave us like 2.5 hours. Of like, here's all the problems I have. Here's what I think you can solve for. And it just kind of started driving our product development. And it was amazing. And I often tell, you know, budding entrepreneurs, you got to find time to meet the biggest, most important customers in the market. It is absolutely scary, but they know so much. They understand their business so much better than a hobby farmer does, right? Who doesn't really understand how much labor costs there are, what's going on. You want to go to the folks who really understand their business. And that's where you get the pain points.
I love it. I think that's such a good insight. And I love that it did work out that you did get to go back because what a bummer if that was the end of the story there. And such a good lesson too about how agriculture works. Like I think it reflects the tech industry more broadly where from their perspective, like this sensor that can save you this much money is the most important thing, but it's not, right? It rains and then getting those cherries covered or sprayed or whatever, like that is the most important thing. And it is absolutely right now. And whatever this device does is going to come second. And that's just how agriculture works, right? You're at the mercy of the weather at times.
Totally. And it's like, and I found, you know, we have humility became like a really important culture aspect of our business. Because when you go to these farms and you come across as like the smart tech guy or gal, I mean, you will go nowhere fast, right? You have to kind of come in like, hey, I'm here to learn, right? And you have to have that humility. Like, we don't know what it's like to farm. And these folks have been farming for generations. They know so much about farming and we know so little. And so having that humility and being open to like, I know I have the solution. Your problem is different. You can't just keep pushing your solution. It's got to be like, listen, and find out what else you can do for them. And that's really helped us. And I'd say 95% of our product has come from customers saying, here's what we want.
That might sound like an obvious insight, but easier said than done, right? Especially if you've got your product roadmap all set out. Then you ask, say, 10 customers what they want, and you hear 8 different things. So how do you balance the vision with being open and responsive to your customers?
We typically focus on the asks that are within our core competencies. So as long as it's within something we can do well, we'll do it even if it was not our roadmap. But if it's outside of that, then we're not going to touch it. So sometimes it means like going after the third or fourth top priority because number one and two, we just can't do, right? So kind of really understanding what are our core competencies and then like driving towards whatever the customer wants. And you're right. So sometimes different customers have different challenges and we deal with like, we're in 12 different crops and they all have different problems. Even by geography, it's different. There are so many different aspects to this business, but there is definitely an overarching sense of like more data to drive decisions, trying to avoid the ups and downs and trying to take away some of the variability in the crops year to year is standard. So that's what we're driving towards.
So fast forwarding a bit, you guys have now raised hundreds of millions of dollars. You've got how many employees now?
So we've raised about $225 million. We've about 300 employees.
And tell me a little bit about that journey in terms of, you know, what it was like for you. You mentioned humility as a value, you know, going from five of you, like the whole company can make the road trip to see the customer. Obviously, that's not possible now. What are a couple lessons that come to mind for you in kind of going on that journey?
It's one of those things that kind of seems to slowly happen almost. So I have found, you know, we're definitely going away from generalists for sure. I used to have a lot of generalists at the beginning who wore five or six different hats. And what often happened is they had some core skill set, but they were kind of extending it. And so we started hiring to take away those things that they weren't great at. So we still kept the people, but we started hiring more and more skill sets there. But we still have this, we're very much a collaborative work culture. Like the expert in the room doesn't get to say what's happening. There's always like this, like, okay, what does everyone think? And so that in some ways precluded me from being able to hire experts who like to be the expert in the room. And so we tended to hire people who were like more curious and want to understand, but knew something about their space. And I found that worked well in our culture. And so it kept up that humility and we were able to sustain it. And I think people who we did hire that didn't quite fit in, they soon left, right? Because it was like too much collaboration, too much talking. You know, let's just move forward. And we're like, no, we want to understand what the problem is and we want to understand what the solutions are. And so I've been able to maintain that. It's really important from what I see as being like the key to our success. And so I drive towards that. And it has been definitely a learning process because you don't, certainly as a chemist, you don't learn anything about people management. I've been to school for a long, long time. I know how to bring atoms together, but people together is not my skill set. And so I definitely have read more books about entrepreneurship and management than I ever thought I would. But I also find it fascinating. I think it's so cool to see like what motivates people, what gets teams working well.
Is there a moment that comes to mind that you're particularly proud of, like, you know, bringing a lesson from a book to bear in the company or kind of bringing the team together in a certain way? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, at one point, I'm not sure if I'd call myself a micromanager, but I was very, very tightly controlling a lot of things at the beginning. And I liked having that visibility and the ability to move things at will was obviously very empowering, right? But at some point, I started getting frustrated by, I was also the biggest blocker because people would wait to ask me and nobody would move without me. And so I said, well, that's not going to scale. And so I started asking other CEOs what they do, and they recommended this book by Vern Harnish called Scaling Up. And it's essentially the Rockefeller Habits management style, but tailored towards companies that are growing fast. So how do you manage communication? How do you set goals? How do you do all these things? And I literally took this book, kind of like how my parents farmed by this book that was like, this is the Bible. This is how we're going to run this company. This one book. And it was a huge risk because it changed everything. And I remember the first meeting we had, we brought in a consultant who specialized in this. And we had my entire leadership team. We got together for 4 days. And we hammered out, what's the one-page plan? What are the three-year, one-year initiatives? We did all that for the first time. And it was hard, like crazy hard. I think we only got through two-thirds of the agenda. It was just way too hard. But we got some of it done. And we started seeing how now, like when people ask me for like, what should we do? I'd say, what is the one page plan say? That should drive it. I shouldn't have to say anything. And we've been doing that. And that was probably 4 years ago now. And we've been doing it ever since. And I still don't make any decisions. And it's fantastic. It's the strategy that drives the entire company.
Michael says he also needed to create a culture that embraced failure. And while this approach is pretty common for startups these days, in the broader ag world, it's definitely not. So it's been a learning curve for many on his team.
It's an innovation thing for me. Like I think creating that safety net for people to take risks, I always felt like I can't ask people to take risks and then slap their wrists when they fail. Like that is such a crazy environment to live in and to work in. And I think it's stressful and it doesn't work well. And so I have from the beginning said, like, we're going to make a ton of mistakes and that we will never fire anybody for a mistake, ever. We'll only fire people for culture, never for making mistakes. And if anything, we're going to come after people and say, listen, you haven't missed a goal in a year. Are you really pushing yourself to try new things? Like, we need you innovating all the way. And, you know, it is probably our biggest advantage when you vis-a-vis like the large multinationals who have deep pockets, all the customers who take zero risks. We have to be taking risks. It's key to our growth. And we have to make that environment that will reward that. So it is a little bit scary. We've had a few events that were like, oof, that was tricky. We had an event once where a bunch of our devices were nearly bricked. So we couldn't access them anymore. And they were not talking to the network anymore. And so we had to go back and hack our way back into them. And it took like, I think 48 hours to get them all back. Like everyone on deck, just kind of backdoor through the communication channel. We call it the apocalypse. It was scary, but you know what? We learned a lot from that process and no one got reprimanded. No one got a bad review. It was like, hey, learn from it and go. And that still is core to our business today. And I tell people coming in, you may not have had that in a prior environment. That doesn't mean you won't be successful here, but know that it's critical to being successful here is embracing risk and creating a safety net amongst your colleagues where when they once in a while stub their toe or fail, it's like, hey, what did we learn from it? And go forward.
Another difference in ag tech is the time that it can take to scale. For Michael, that means managing investor expectations. And it means making sure you choose the right investors.
Yeah, it's definitely been a bit of a minefield for sure. A lot of Silicon Valley bets have been on types of technologies and companies that scale at incredible rates. I mean, think of how Zoom did during COVID. I mean, insane. The kind of growth you see there is what everybody wants, right? And it's, you know, when you have IoT and you have hardware and you have field services and people involved and scaling, that is so unlikely to happen. You know, I'd almost say it's impossible. And so I think a lot of these investors that has to be on the table for them to go in. And I know we're going to have an amazing growth trajectory and we're doing well and we're doing as planned and it's going to keep going that way. But I could never do like a, you know, 10x revenue year over year. It was not going to happen for us. And so even though we would be a success in their books, they can't afford to bet on us because they need to bet on people who can go the 10x in a year for their math to work. And so that was always a challenge. And I didn't want to be in a position where I had to overcommit our growth rate. And then all of a sudden, like I'm pushing my team in ways that I knew they could not be successful at. So it was important we found the right investors. And I spoke to a lot of investors and was able to find folks who did believe that the market we were in was absolutely massive. There were major step changes coming to this market, but that we would kind of go in and we'd have low churn rate, we'd have a high switching cost, and we would grow this market, but it would be at the rate that the market can handle.
You were talking before about sort of true believers, right? These people that actually are kind of going to believe in it for the right reason and be on board. That's what we talk about, at least with investors, is how important it is to qualify. And any kind of tactics or advice for entrepreneurs out there raising right now that are in this similar struggle of kind of bridging this gap between ag and venture?
To be fair, I do tell my investors that the 10x is there, it's just not in a year, right? So it's all about timeline. So for me, it's all about what timeline do you have? If you want a 10X in the next year, that's not going to happen. But if you have the patience for it, we can probably even beat that. So it's all about timelines for them. So how patient is the capital? And so we've been able to find folks who actually had that patience, who had that timeline horizon. And that paid off well for us.
The ag tech ecosystem has matured enough that we now have a mix of startups from very early to later stages. But it means we also have the messy middle, the companies that are past early stage, but are still risky, where the tech or demand isn't quite proven out. So is it even harder in ag tech to get past this messy middle? This might be moving to a completely different geography or a different crop type, for example, and it's not easy. I asked Michael how Semius was going in terms of getting to the other side of this curve, or valley of death, as it's sometimes called.
I mean, we look a lot at the ecosystem right now. You know, there's probably close to 1,000 ag tech companies out there today, if not more. And I'd say the vast majority, I don't know, probably over 85% have less than $1 million in revenue. Like there's a lot of them who are just kind of just starting. I'm surprised we haven't seen more activity from the big multinationals. Like they've been kind of sitting on the sidelines for a while now. And, you know, we did see quite a bit of consolidation amongst the multinationals, like the big six became the big three. And the other challenge that I see is there isn't a great retail channel for ag tech. You know, that the ag retail channel is designed for chemicals, seeds, and tractors, and not for software, IoT, and sensors. And so the ones who do are kind of doing it on the side of their desks, and it's not really what they're focused on. And I'm seeing now a lot of smaller young companies coming and want to get to the market. And we're actually seeing an opportunity for Semios to step up and in some ways become a retail channel, like an, almost like an app store to help tech get to these customers. Because there's no other way they're going to get there. It's really, really hard. And the channels that exist are not designed. They don't know how to sell software. They don't. I remember back in the day where like we were working through a channel and a customer would forget their password. And it's like the sky was falling. I was like, dude, there's a button right there. You press the button. It's not a big deal. But it was like, they're just not designed for that. And they're not incentivized for it. It's just all broken. And so either we need to have a truly independent retail channel that shows up and sells, or we're going to start doing it for a lot of folks.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, kind of what does it mean to stay independent in this space, given that so much of the channel is incentivized on other products and even the acquisitions we've seen really now are sort of loss leaders to sell other products. What, how do you guys kind of think about independence?
For whatever reason, the ag market kind of let itself get away with the pharmacist and the doctor being the same person, right? And that is just not a great business model, right? And when the person recommending you products is the one that sells them to you, you're bound to get some bias. But whatever, it came to be, and it has been working somewhat well. But I think what we're seeing now is, especially around the larger farming operations, which are getting bigger and bigger now, they're not buying that at all. They're like getting their own advice, independent advisors. And now they're kind of wondering why they're buying through the retail channel, because they don't want the advice anyways. Should they go direct? So that's going to get super challenged right now. As farms get bigger, that model of like, hey, just trust me, here's what you need, is not going to work anymore. So when I think about that retail channel being challenged in terms of that the doctor and pharmacist combination being challenged, I think that more and more farmers are going to value an independent steward of the data. So they're going to want to see data obviously being grown and created more value and more insights, but trying to keep it just arm's length away from the chemicals, seed providers, and then advice providers. So we want to keep that somewhat independent, but at scale. And right now that's the challenge, is those data stewards are not at scale yet. And so we're now striving to become that.
And when you have that data, broader incentives can come into play, such as sustainability-linked loans or other financial incentives. There's also the potential of new products entering the market, such as biologicals. But how can you actually capture the value of these market trends? Michael says he's considering all of these possibilities.
I think there will be a switch from more traditional, broad insecticide approaches to more specific biologicals. But I think more important is going to be around the timing of applications and the number of applications. And so like in Europe, the Green Deal is now, they're now going to mandate a 50% reduction in all chemicals, whether they're biologicals or not. I think you're going to see more push towards like, what's the timing and what locations are you spraying, and getting that more accurate. And so I do believe that data will be core to that, and understanding risks and forecasting them is going to be important. One of the challenges in ag tech that I see is that you need the granularity of your data and the granularity of your ability to deliver on that have to kind of go hand in hand. If you can tell the grower by the tree what's happening, but they can only spray by the block, you kind of lost it, right? So they're kind of going step in step right now. I think data got a little bit ahead. So we're focusing on the control systems. How do we get those up as well so we can watch them? But that's where this has to go. And I think it's going to get there. And ultimately, that's what sustainability needs. And a lot of the traditional chemicals work really well. You try to manage how much you put out there. And they are obviously very potent, but you don't need to spray the whole field every 2 weeks. And that is simply not required.
Yeah. in the tech world, again, kind of drawing parallels between the two, there's this narrative of going from the kind of premium product or higher value, then kind of going down market as you come down the cost curve and you can open up new markets now that you're more affordable. Do you think the same narrative kind of applies in agriculture, you know, starting in specialty and expanding out into broad acre? Do the, you know, differences in supply chain weigh on your mind there? Or is that just a total oversimplification?
No, I think it's true. One of the things that I liked about the permanent crop or the high value crop space is that there was relatively little investment here. Like back when out in the early 2000s, you know, everybody was doing broad acres, right? That's when Climate Corp was going gangbusters and everybody was looking at row crops. I think at one point I saw it was like, of the $45 billion invested in ag tech, like 43 was on broad acres. Like it was just like, it got more than the lion's share. So I was like, well, I kind of want to go where it's less busy and create my own little niche space. So that's kind of what drove that. But we've been looking hard at all the types of crops, and there's lots in between broad acres and permanent crops, right? What we often find is that the number of sensors required to monitor those crops tends to be a lot less. And so the cost, the COGS come down, which means we can actually make money at and charge less, but still make money on those acres. And so I do believe there's going to be room for all that to happen. And a recent acquisition of AgWorld obviously brought in a lot of broad acres. And we're now going through a process of understanding what those crops mean, how we can best approach them. But I do believe that our solution, both on the IoT side and the data analytics, will help in those environments.
Hmm. Going back to your kind of strategy and these parallels between the kind of business, I guess, playbooks and ag tech, are there templates for businesses or business models in other industries that you sort of look to and say, yes, we're trying to be the X of ag tech, or this is a playbook that really resonates with what we're trying to do?
Kind of. One of the things that we use a lot is, I think it's Jim Collins, had a model around the flywheel. Okay. And the most common business one is like Amazon's flywheel. Like, how do you start accelerating? And so we've been kind of like watching for like, is there a flywheel in our business? And what does it look like? And how do we focus on it? And I think we have identified one that we believe works. And so we're focused on that to see how we can grow and accelerate our business. And so that's what we're looking at. I mean, obviously Amazon's been a massive success story. But just the scale that they have is incredible. And then it's that whole model of like growing, keeping kind of cash flow neutral, but just growing, 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 right? And so I think we're going to probably follow that model as close as we can. It's definitely going to be a land grab in this market. It's going to be about digitizing those acres and offering some services and becoming sticky and offering more value. And it's going to be a race. And so it's good to be well capitalized and going after acquisitions that can help that.
Love it. You mentioned recently on LinkedIn that you've been talking to your kids about the food system and kind of transparency and where food comes from. Do they think what you do is cool or not very cool?
Yeah, I think kids never think their parents are cool, especially when they're teenagers. We're not that cool, but they do. They hear a lot at the dinner table in terms of kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing, and I tell them about the types of regions we're going into, like, you know, I'm going to Argentina this week, I'm going to Europe this week, and here's the types of crops that are there. I often talk about like how far food has to travel to get to our plate and what does it mean to be in season versus not in season and how that affects us. So yeah, I do think they see the value in food and they appreciate kind of the selection we have today and the amazing, I mean, my son actually works in a grocery store in the produce department. So he sees like all the stuff and it's amazing what we have. And what we have to do to maintain that for like all 7, soon to be 10 billion people on the planet.
Yeah. I never realized how much those dinner table conversations, I mean, it goes back to your parents and the hobby farm and kind of how these dots end up connecting. My dad worked in the semiconductor industry. He's always been an entrepreneur and investor. And when people are like, you know, how did you end up starting your own company and being an investor and all this stuff? It's like, well, I just, you know, you don't kind of connect those dots until you realize, well, you didn't know any other playbook because those were the dinner table conversations. You know, he was talking about people management and who do you hire and how do you grow this business and how do you talk to investors? And then it just sort of, I don't know, gets into you, I guess. So sounds like some of that happening in your house as well.
For sure. Yeah. And they're looking at that and seeing like, what does it mean? Like, you know, I think they look at, am I happy doing what I'm doing? Like, you know, how hard is it? I think there's a natural path to like, I want to do something that's going to make me happy. So they're trying to pick up on, you know, do I like my job or not? And what are the benefits of it? What aren't? And so, it's good to share that with the kids.
That's fantastic. Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been super awesome to see your guys' success and to learn more about your personal story and some of the things you've learned. I will ask you one last question. What is your favorite Will Ferrell gif? Because I saw that in your LinkedIn profile and it made me laugh. So you will either have to tell me or share one with me after for us to share.
Yeah, there's so many. I love them all. My goodness. I'm such a big Will Ferrell fan. I think my latest favorite one is from Step Brothers, where he asks the parents, like, can they redo their bedroom? And the parents are like, well, you're adults, so, you know, do whatever you want. And they're like, so what's the answer? Like, they're kind of like, I don't understand. And so I love that one. So I use it all the time now.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thank you to Michael Gilbert, CEO and founder of Semios, for joining me. Next episode, we'll continue our series on lessons from later stage ag tech founders by hearing from Paul Lightfoot, a serial entrepreneur and the founder and president of Bright Farms. All the resources from this episode are on our website, agtechsowhat.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.